Srimad Bhagavatam, third canto, chapter 7. Further inquiries by the Yajnasya cha vitanani, yogasya cha patatprabho, naishkarmyasya cha sankhyasya, tantram va bhagavat smitam, yajnasya of sacrifices, cha also, vitanani, expansions, yogasya, of the mystic powers, cha, also, pata, ways, prabho, O my Lord, naiskarmyasya, of knowledge, cha, and sankhyasya, of analytical studies, tantram, the path of devotional service. Va, as well as. Bhagavat, in relation with the personality of Godhead. Smritam, regulative principles. Translation. Please also describe the expansions of different sacrifices and the paths of mystic powers, analytical study of knowledge, and devotional service, all with their respective regulations. Purport. The word tantram is significant herein. Sometimes tantram is misunderstood to be black spiritual science of materialistic persons engaged in sense gratification. But here tantra means the science of devotional service compiled by Srila Narada Muni. One can take advantage of such regulative explanations of the path of devotional service and make progressive advancement in the devotional service of the Lord. Sankhya philosophy is the basic principle of acquiring knowledge, as will be explained by the sage Maitreya. The Sankhya philosophy enunciated by Kapila Dev, the son of Devahuti, is the real source of knowledge about the supreme truth. Knowledge not based on the Sankhya philosophy is mental speculation and can yield no tangible profit. Om Jnana Timirandasya Jnananjana Shalakaya Chakshun Militam Yena Tasmai Sri Guruve Namaha. Jai Sri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Sri Advaita Galadhar Shivasati Gaur Bhakta Vrinda. Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare. In these inquiries by Vidura, you're getting a picture of what the elements of a real human civilization are. No doubt you won't find all these elements in anywhere near a fully developed state today. But it is important to understand what is the real standard of human civilization. What's missing? Because otherwise, we will accept the elements of civilization today as being really progressive and advanced. When you read about the expansions of different sacrifices, the paths of mystic powers, analytical study of knowledge, and of course devotional service, you start to understand that a real human civilization offers options for spiritual development. Of course, the ultimate option is bhakti, but in human civilization, not everyone is fortunate enough to take directly to bhakti immediately. So a real human civilization has other progressive aspects, even progressive just in terms of pious activities and avoiding impious activities. So it's important for us to understand that full picture. Otherwise, we are easily duped by the so-called advancement of society today, in which there are five basic myths that are predominant today. Number one is that money brings happiness. Number two, technology brings prosperity and well-being. Number three, weapons bring security. The more fierce your weapons, the greater you can feel secure. And actually, four myths. The earth provides unlimited resources for your exploitation, and the earth is an unlimited sink which will receive unlimited waste from your exploitation processes. So these myths are the foundation of materialistic society today. It's good for us to know that in a real materialistic society, people are concerned with how to balance their pious and impious activities. That's materialism, but it's sane materialism. People are concerned how to go to the heavenly planets. Again, materialism, but it's sane materialism. What you have today is not, actually, it's a compliment to call people materialists today. Because by calling them materialists, you're implying that they're expert at material things, which they are not. I often point out in outreach programs, tell me one other species that destroys its own habitat in the name of progress and advancement. Only human beings today are doing that, and they can't stop it. The governments can't stop it. The leaders can't agree on how to restrict their damage to their own habitat. The people can't control themselves. In spite of so much verbosity and research and studies and PhDs, no one can figure out that people need to learn how to control their minds and senses. All the talk about sustainable happiness, sustainable environment, sustainable this, sustainable that, it all depends on controlling the mind and senses. But no one has a program for that. The Vedic sages, especially in the Bhagavad school, are always grappling with this issue of how people can become purified. Just like in the Bhagavatam, in the fifth canto, Shukadeva Goswami had described the hellish planets. So in the sixth canto, then Prichit Maharaj expresses his concern. You've described how people can destroy themselves by going to hellish situations. I'd like to know how they can become purified. That quest for purification is the hallmark of a real human civilization. And therefore, Prichit Maharaj's inquiry, of course, is so important. Actually, Srila Prabhupada pointed out that this first part of the sixth canto is so essential, not so much because of the near-death experience of Ajamya, but because it presents the triumph of the holy name in all circumstances. So he actually instructed that the first part of sixth canto should always be in print as a mass distribution book. Of course, many are attracted to the story of Ajamil in terms of near death, but most important, beyond the details of the NDE, most important is the theology of the holy name and pure bhakti. So Prichit Maharaj is going through the various levels of a human society that's for real. In other words, a human society that's concerned with purification and removing the deadly effects of punya, sinful activity. So, Shukadeva Goswami is going to test Pritchett Maharaj. How can people get free from sinful reactions? By atonement. And of course, Pritchett Maharaj gives his famous answer, Prayashtitam Mato Partam, Manye Kunjara Shocha. It's like taking an elephant bath. You perform sinful activity, and then you perform a pious activity to counteract it. You'll never get to the root of the problem. So this is good materialism, that you recognize that in living in this world, you're going to make some mistakes. So therefore, you do some good deeds, and those good deeds are not what people think today. A good deed is whatever way you want to help people and feel good about it, that's a good deed. That's good karma. No. Pious activities, punya, are described explicitly in the Vedic texts. So a good materialist is concerned. I want the best possible outcome. Not simply in the present, but also in the future. Future means next life. So how can I do all that? Pritchett Maharaj is pointing out, in response to Shukadeva Goswami's test, that this is a very ineffective method, performing a pious activity to counteract an impious activity. It's problematic. Karma is so complex. The laws of karma are so complex. You're sure to make a mistake in that system. Somehow or other, you're going to slip up. Just like you read in the Krishna Lila about Maharaj Nirga, who performed such immense pious activities, but he made one slip. This is why, later in the sixth canto, when the Yama Dutas are dialoguing with the Vishnu Dutas, the Vishnu Dutas challenge, do you know actually who should be punished or who should not be punished? And the Yama Dutas replied that, basically, sooner or later, we're going to see everyone. Because you can't live in this world unless you're a bhakta. You can't live in this world and avoid tripping up, avoid doing some activity of bad karma. So therefore, the Yama Dutas said, more or less, we're going to come across everyone. Maybe not now, but maybe in your next life or 10 births from now, we'll be there for you. Because you're gonna slip up. The nature of the material world is that you're entangled, you're blinded, you're bewildered. This is why Pritchett Maharaj rejected Shukadeva Goswami's first proposal to atone by performing a pious activity to counteract an impious activity. So then Shukadeva Goswami went to the next step. All right, you don't like that. How about Priyashtatam Vimarsana? You cleanse the sinful reactions by full knowledge, understanding what is pious, what is impious. And through immersion in full knowledge, you can prevent a lifestyle of bewilderment or a lifestyle of problems with material nature. Still, Pritchett Maharaj said that doesn't work. He pointed out that it's just like a bamboo plant. You may burn away what's above the earth, what's above the surface of the earth, but what about the roots? What will pull out the roots of sinful desires? None of the methods that Shukadeva Goswami presented get to the root of the problem. That root is, I think I'm the enjoyer and controller. What is going to rid the conditioned soul of that horrible tendency? So that's when Shukadeva Goswami presents the ultimate and only real solution. Pure devotional service, which just like when the sun rises and dispels all the fog, similarly, pure bhakti dispels completely the intricacies caused by contact with material nature. Someone who's actually concerned with the welfare of human civilization wants to understand what are the elements of a real human civilization. There's no question of solving the social, political, ecological ills of society today unless at least you begin to recognize the necessity for, as you heard in the previous verse, mental equilibrium and sense control. You can hear from the greatest scholars of sustainability, the greatest scholars and proponents of what they now call sustainable happiness, as different from regular happiness. No one has a program for mind and sense control. All these PhDs, they construct such grand theories and proposals. We've got to cut back on this. We have to reduce our emissions. We have to reduce here and reduce there. But no one talks about mind and sense control. One famous environmentalist, he was advocating that once again people take up rural life. But he said there's a problem. When people move out into the rural areas, they feel isolated and they get bored very quickly. Therefore, they want to go back to the cities. But in these days, the whole problem of the rural exodus to the cities can be solved by making sure every rural home has the internet. And then people will feel completely connected, even though they're in rural areas and living simply. Of course, what is 80% of internet usage? Pornography. So no one has a proposal. No one's dealing with the necessity for mind and sense control. And mind and sense control is just it's kindergarten in Vedic civilization. In this verse today, Vidura is asking, please describe these various factors, the expansions of different sacrifices, because a real human civilization is based on yajna. You recognize that you're indebted. You recognize that just by your existence in this world, you have to pay fees, user fees. And the yajna system is a prescribed way for paying the user fees, acknowledging that you're in debt, and also acknowledging your gratitude. So without a system of sacrifice in society, there's no way that people will recognize their dependency, recognize that they're in debt, and can properly express their gratitude. And then the paths of mystic power. Vishwanatha Chakravarti Thakur, in his commentary, describes that this is referring, this yogasya, paths of mystic power, is referring to Ashtanga Yoga, which, of course, in the age of Kali, will not bring you the culmination of its effects. Still, in a full-fledged human civilization, you have those who are dedicated to meditating on the super soul in the heart through Ashtanga Yoga. And then Sankhyasya, analytical study. This means looking at material nature and through a process prescribed by the Vedic knowledge. Not that you just look at material nature and speculate and call that Sankhya. There's a prescribed way, a delineated way, for how to analyze material existence and get to the root. That's the whole point of real Sankhya, to get to the root of material existence. So therefore, Prabhupada writes in the purport, Sankhya philosophy is the basic principle of acquiring knowledge, as will be explained by the sage Maitreya. The Sankhya philosophy enunciated by Kapiladeva, the son of Devahuti, is the real source of knowledge about the Supreme Truth. Knowledge not based on the Sankhya philosophy is mental speculation and can yield no tangible profit. If you actually follow Kapiladeva's Sankhya process, you'll get to the root. That's the purpose of knowledge. If you follow your own speculations in trying to analyze the material world, you'll never get to the root. You'll be bewildered lifetime after lifetime. Take away all these elements of a real human civilization. And of course, the culmination of a real human civilization is bhakti. That's why it is stated at the end here, Tantram va Bhagavat Smritam. The path of devotional service in relation with the personality of Godhead. A real human civilization is so merciful and so broad that it's able to take in all kinds of persons at different levels and gradually, if not immediately, bring them to bhakti. Take away all that and you're just left with the crudest kind of civilization, which is actually not materialistic. Because, as we said earlier, to call someone a materialist implies that they're expert at living material life. And we don't give them that credit. They're expert at destroying themselves. They're lousy materialists. A good materialist wants to enjoy now and next life. But who has that kind of thinking today? Then again, you can say accurately that they are materialists because so many of their leading intellectuals think, their leading scientists think, that there's nothing but matter and nothing beyond that. Actually, most people don't accept that. You'll find that in doing outreach, that most people think there's something spiritual about me, they have some spiritual intuition, but zero knowledge about it. Even, for example, I saw one social survey done in the UK. The UK is known as one of the least religious societies in the world. So, even though church attendance is so low, basically only immigrants go to church. You know, the British, they don't go to church. But still, only 13% of the people say that they believe that there's simply matter and nothing more. So the atheists in the UK, they complain that these people are not really irreligious. They have some spiritual notion of an afterlife, no matter how vague, or some kind of soul, but they have no definitive knowledge of it. Yet they have these mythologies. So how can they really be irreligious? They have to become more advanced. They need to face the facts that there's just matter, just physical forces of the universe, nothing more. But actually, you'll find people have a hard time accepting that. They don't have any spiritual knowledge, but most of them can't just embrace the fact that they're just chemicals and that's all. You know, they always, I can't go that far. So this is the situation. There's a new term to describe these kind of persons who they don't espouse any religion, they're not following any spiritual path, they're not following any spiritual guidelines, they're not even thinking about anything spiritual. At the same time, they can't just embrace matterism, physical reductionism, everything is just matter. So what's the word for them? It's called apatheism. They're apathetic. Australia is like that, you know. You know, not that they're against religion, not that they're against spiritual thinking, but just who thinks about it, you know? There's sports, there's the pub, there's there's money, there's the beach. So this is called apatheism. They're not theists, but they're actually not atheists. They haven't, with their thought process, fully embraced an atheistic conclusion. Just, you know, theism, atheism, whatever. Where are the girls? That's the mindset. So you're forced, in that ignorance, you're forced to just glorify the moment. And that's what you have going on in society today. The magic of the moment. Just get some good moments in your life. And that's the full potential. Have a few moments of relationship bliss. Have some good sensuality. And then you die in peace. What more is there? Can't expect anything more than that. The happiness scholars, they, as I often point out, their general proposition is that 50% of your happiness is genetic. It's due to the genes you've inherited, and therefore you have a certain disposition. Supposedly parents can remember their child was from birth a cheery child or a very melancholy child. So, according to happiness scientists, 50% of your happiness is due to genes, genetic code. 10% is due to situations that are difficult to change. Your work, where you live, your marriage, they can be changed, but you can't do it overnight. It takes a long time. So that's 10%. So that totals 60%, they say. And 40% is left to you and your own intention. And with that 40%, you can intend to be happy. You make up your mind to be happy no matter what. You've got that 40% window. But I tell people that bhakti is offering 100%. Bhakti is not dependent on your genes. It's not dependent on your situations. So you've got 100% opportunity to hear Krishna's instructions and follow them and rise above material nature. Because as long as you are a puppet in the hands of material nature, you're never going to be happy, no matter how much intention you have, your 40% so-called intention. I will be happy no matter what. You're being dashed here and there by material nature. But people can't even see that. That's how low their civilization is. They can't even see their puppets in the hands of material nature. I glanced over one account of a person who the happiness scientists are putting forth as a model happy person. This person had made up his mind, no matter what, to be happy. He would inspire others to be happy. And when people at his work were asked, do you know any truly happy persons here? The people at his workplace would always point to him. He's always happy. So the happiness scientist wanted to make a point that this person was so expert at being happy that even in so-called tragedies, he still kept his intention to be happy. And this is the kind of inspiration that the people need. So, this topmost happy person, he went to the doctor, and the doctor told him that some disease that he had, which was in remission, had reappeared, and that he had only 7 months to live. So, the happiness scientists, some of them Nobel Prize winners, they were describing how this expert in happiness responded, this person who's supposedly expert in living a happy life. How did he respond? First, he was just slammed, like, oh my God, 7 months to live. But then his happiness instincts took over him. And he says, okay, I'm going to take control of the situation. Doctor, tell me, for how long will I have enough energy to travel and meet all my relatives and friends? I'm taking charge of the situation. I'm going to be happy. Doctor, tell me, how will I manage the pain? Tell me all I need to do to manage the pain so that I can live a full life to the last minute. Explain everything to me, Doctor. Just like Vidura is asking Maitreya to explain everything to him. So, Doctor, explain to me, what will my passing be like? Maybe should I consider what they call an assisted death? Means someone helps you to just finish you off, gives you some pills or something like that. Should I have an assisted death, or should I have a death this way or that way? I'm taking complete charge. So, what did he do? He got the jnana from the doctor, and he traveled the world going to all the spots he wanted to see. He visited all his friends and relatives, and then he died a good death. So this is what the happiness scholars are presenting. This is a real life. So what do you say? A real life means to submit to material nature? We don't accept that. Just let nature's laws act upon me. I have no understanding of those laws of nature or how to counteract them, how to rise above them. I'm a happy person. I just live for the moment and don't care what is my future birth. I saw my relatives and friends. I traveled everywhere I wanted to see in the world before I died. I had pain management up to the last moment. I could choose if I go to a certain states or certain countries of the world. I can choose an assisted death. So, I've done it. That's it. We don't accept this kind of civilization. A real human civilization begins with at least the elements of a plan, a process for counteracting material nature. Without that kind of understanding, your life is a failure. I remember once Srila Prabhupada describing very graphically this lifestyle of let nature's laws act upon me. He called it, this is a dog's life. The dog is also doing that. I'm going with the flow of nature. Let nature act upon me. The dog, of course, does that instinctively. But if a human being lives like that, just go with the flow. It's all natural. Birth, death, old age, disease. Just accept it. Be happy amidst all that. We say this is not human life. So you have to see in yourself how much those contaminations are there. Western so-called civilization is based upon the dynamic of just, it's all about the moment. Even the Christian morality, one life is all you get. If you slip up, you burn in fire. If you do good, you go to heaven. It's one chance is all you get. So you got to make sure you're doing good things right now. And even though you're sinning, you just believe in the Savior. But you got to make sure you do all that. Even that's out the window now. Everything is all about the magic moment. How many magic moments have you had in your life? Look at your relationships. Are they still magical? Maybe you need to make a change. Is the job you're doing really inspiring you? Is it fulfilling you? Maybe you need to make a change. It's not too late. That's the best that society can give you. The magic of the moment. Good sense gratification. Help others to gratify their senses. That's doing a good deed. Good karma means helping others to gratify their senses. That's it. And then you can die in peace. There may be an afterlife. There may not be. but it's not important for you to figure it out. Just try to be a good person your own way, and surely the universe will take care of you. So this is so-called Western civilization. Now even in India, you know, they're catching up. Yes, this is such an attractive lifestyle. Why should you feel so fettered and so bound by prescriptions of human behavior? So this is why we need to understand the complete picture of a real human civilization. Because so deep in the Western world is this drive to just feel good for the moment. And sometimes our devotees really have to wrestle with that. My senses are not being gratified at this moment. Is that good? There must be a problem. I'm believing in Krishna, but what about my senses? We have this corrupted idea that happiness will come by just letting your senses go wild. Where do we get this idea from? It's insane, but it's so deeply embedded in us because we're living in a consumer society with media distortions. And so these false assumptions go deep in us. So how to scrub all these deep assumptions, these mistakes? This is Prichit Maharaj's concern. He was concerned not only in a real human civilization, but in any attempt at human civilization, how are you going to get to those core root assumptions, those mistakes of thinking you're the enjoyer and controller? So therefore, when Shukadeva Goswami described only pure bhakti can completely eradicate the mistaken assumptions of the conditioned soul, Prichit Maharaj accepted that. All right. Any questions? Any comments from Banu Maharaj? Can it be sattva if this life is full of rajaguna activities, the basis?
Well, as you said, probably the better part of these people will do some more humanitarian type, sattvic, compassion activities, and they won't go for the upright things like drugs and things like this. So maybe they'll try to control that to some degree. Of course, some people will get into that, but that's also everybody knows it's the start of it. So the goal for those things would maintain the body, give it the
organic
food,
marijuana. Marijuana is practically legal everywhere. In the Netherlands, right? It's like water. Even in the Christian USA, marijuana is, so many states are legalizing. Washington, D.C. just legalized possession of marijuana. My mother she's 87. She was railing about that. Just see how sinful the world's becoming. Washington, D.C. has legalized marijuana. This degradation shows that Jesus is coming soon. The second coming is the any moment. So the standards of what's a good life, they change all the time. Just like in Western society, divorce used to be a bad thing. I mean, in the 50s, if someone got divorced, it was unusual and it was looked down upon. Now in the Western world, divorce, it was a big deal. If you're not happy with someone, why should you stay with that person? And it's best for the children. If the parents are not happy with each other, it's better for the children that the parents divorce, because you don't want the children growing up with parents who are not happy with each other all the time. And anyway, the children will do the same thing when they get older. So why should the parents try to control themselves for the sake of the children when soon the children become teenagers, they're going to be chopping and changing relationships based on their momentary happiness. So the standard for what is good is always changing. So I told that to my mother. I said, 40 years ago when your children were at the university, you were so concerned whether you were smoking marijuana or not. You considered it from the devil, and from the social point of view, you considered it to be reprehensible and very abominable. I said, what are you going to say now? It's legal everywhere. So the standards of what is good and what is nice, they're always changing. And no one has any fixed idea of what are the progressive elements of a real civilization. But sometimes I would wonder, why did the Bhagavatam go into all these things about different yajñas and mystic powers and Sankhya this and so on and so forth? But you, after a while, you realize you're getting an overview of what is a real human civilization. And you start more and more to understand that you don't find truly progressive elements in human society today. So besides understanding that bhakti is the ultimate, you also get the whole picture. I always tell the story of one Sankirtan devotee told me. She approached someone on the street in Auckland with a book, and immediately the person said, no, I don't need it, I'm good. I know I'm good. And then he explained why. I know I'm good because, number one, I don't molest children. Number two, I don't park in car parks meant for the handicapped. I'm good. Any questions? Always be positive. This book is about being happy. Well, I'm happy, I'm good. Great, it's for you then. The books are for everyone. Whether they think they're happy, they think they're Christians, they think they're Muslims, whatever, the books are for them. Yeah, this is for you. Because it helps them to be even more happy. And because they're happy now, they should be interested in such a book that helps them be even more happy. Actually, it all depends on one's purity and the other person's good fortune. So you do your best. Not everyone's going to take. Srila Prabhupada once described the process of what happens when you approach someone with a book. If your motive is pure, then the supersoul in your heart notices that, and the supersoul in their heart tells the person, take the book. But sometimes your motive may not be the best, and they have no motive, but still the super soul tells them to take it. So Prabhupada said that's Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. Just like sometimes there's no clouds in the sky, but still rain comes. Similarly, sometimes there's no cause, but still people can engage in devotional service. So that is Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. That is his mercy. Mercy on you, that you can engage in that activity, and mercy on them, that they can take a book. And remember, just by taking the book in their hand and appreciating, this is very nice, but not today. Right here in Melbourne, Prabhupada explained that that appreciation is actually Shraddha. And it's enough to give them a human form of life and an expert. So how can you lose by doing that activity? Yes. Even if a small percentage become fully Krishna conscious, that's enough to change the world. And even those who don't take up the bhakti path fully, they'll be influenced, they'll have some interactions that will make their life more fortunate in this life and the next. We don't know. We can't measure materially the full effects of the Sankirtan movement. For example, I remember in New York City in 1973 as a young devotee, there were so many gods and avatars flooding New York City. Every day at the international airport, a new god would arrive on Air India. You can't imagine what it was like. It was nothing like it was now. There were so many of these. You'd go out to distribute books in Manhattan, and every fifth person you meet would say, "My guru's god. Why are you holding this book out to me? Don't you know there's such and such Baba, he's god. Or such and such Rishi, he's god. Or Yogi so and so, he's god." Every fifth person. So I remember Prabhupada at that time, he came to New York and he said, "Go on with this Harinam Sankirtan, this book distribution. One day, all these bogus gods and yogis, they'll be diminished." It was hard for us to accept that. It was like saying, one day there won't be any sunshine. It's like they were so omnipresent. But then we indeed saw within a year or two, the supply coming in on Air India, it all diminished. There were just a few. Like now, there's just very few who will go around campaigning, "I am God, you are God." But in 73, there was one who would fill a whole sports stadium with 60,000 people. The boy God. Similarly, Prabhupada told us if his books are distributed behind the Iron Curtain, communism is finished. It seemed impossible. When the Iron Curtain fell, even the CIA said they were caught off guard. They never expected it was going to unravel like that. So we don't know the full effects of distributing bhakti. There are even effects you can see in the material sphere. What to speak of the spiritual sphere. So we do our little bit as humble servants of the parampara. another question. As we go through difficulties, do we artificially keep ourselves happy just to inspire others? By associating with devotees who are more advanced than you, you'll become more advanced. Even when you have to make a gallant effort in bhakti, later you'll recognize that it's actually happiness. You see, what's going on, your conceptions of happiness are changing. So you have to give that a chance to happen. You're moving from me-centered, so-called happiness to Krishna-centered happiness. So in the beginning, it can look like pain. But that's just a misperception. What's happening is we're making that shift from serving our own mind and senses and being concerned with me, 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 to being concerned with Krishna's pleasure, Krishna's service. So in the transition towards that, it can seem like we're not happy, even when we're suffering. We're in the convalescent stage. We're getting over the disease. We're not completely healthy yet, but we're making progress away from the disease. So understand the dynamics of what's going on. Your whole conception is of happiness is changing. Your whole experience of happiness is changing. Instead of everything for me and my senses, how do I feel? It's how can Krishna best be served? Remember earlier in this chapter, Vidura said to Maitreya, or is it Maitreya said it to Vidura in their conversation? There are only two kinds of people who can be happy in this world. One is the self-realized soul, and the other is the complete fool. Everyone in between suffers a bit of anxiety. Of course, the complete fool thinks he's happy through such low-grade activities. And the completely enlightened person has no, seeks to derive nothing from material nature in terms of gratification or happiness. But everyone in between feels some twinges of anxiety. So therefore, as you're making progress to being a completely enlightened soul, you're going to feel some anxieties. But understand you're in the convalescent stage. You're getting well. Srimad Bhagavatam, third canto, chapter 7. Further inquiries by the Yajnasya cha vitanani.
Yajnasya cha
Yogasya cha patap prabho.
Yogasya cha patap prabho.
Naishkamyasya cha samkhyasya.
Naishkamyasya samkhyasya.
Tantram va bhagavat smitam.
Tantram va bhagavat smitam.
Yajnasya of sacrifices. Cha also. Vitanani. Expansions. Yogasya. Of the mystic powers. Cha, also. Cha, ways. Prabhu, O my Lord. Nice karmyasya. Of knowledge. Cha, and. Sankhyasya. Of analytical studies. Tantram. The path of devotional service. Va, as well as. Bhagava. In relation with the personality of Godhead. Smritam, regulative principles. Translation. Please also describe the expansions of different sacrifices and the paths of mystic powers, analytical study of knowledge, and devotional service, all with their respective regulations. The word tantram is significant herein,
Sometimes Tantrum is misunderstood to be black spiritual science of materialistic persons engaged in sense gratification. But here Tantrum means the science of devotional service compiled by Srila Narayana. One can take advantage of such regulative explanations of the path of devotional service and make progressive advancement in the devotional service of the Lord. Sankhya philosophy is the basic principle of acquiring knowledge, as will be explained by the sage Maitreya. The Sankhya philosophy enunciated by Kapila Dev, the son of Devahuti, is the real source of knowledge about the supreme truth. Knowledge not based on the Sankhya philosophy is mental speculation and can yield no tangible profit. Om Jnanatimirandasya Jnananjana Shalakaya Chakshun Militam Yena Tasmai Sri Gurave Namaha Jai Sri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Sri Advaita Gadabha Srivastava Gaur Bhaktavrinda Hare Krishna Hare Krishna 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 Hare 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 Rama Hare Rama 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 Hare Hare. In these inquiries by Vidura, you're getting a picture of what the elements of a real human civilization are. No doubt you won't find all these elements in anywhere near a fully developed state today. But it is important to understand what is the real standard of human civilization. What's missing? Because otherwise, we will accept the elements of civilization today as being really progressive and advanced. When you read about the expansions of different sacrifices, the past of mystic powers, analytical study of knowledge, and of course devotional service, you start to understand that a real human civilization offers options for spiritual development. Of course, the ultimate option is bhakti, but in human civilization, not everyone is fortunate enough to take directly to bhakti immediately. So, a real human civilization has other progressive aspects, even progressive just in terms of pious activities and avoiding impious activities. So it's important for us to understand that full picture. Otherwise, we're easily duped by the so-called advancement of society today, in which there are five basic myths that are predominant today. Number one is that money brings happiness. Number two, technology brings prosperity and well-being. Number three, weapons bring security. The more fierce your weapons, the greater you can feel secure. And actually, four myths. The earth provides unlimited resources for your exploitation, and the earth is an unlimited sink which will receive unlimited waste from your exploitation processes. So these myths are the foundation of materialistic society today. It's good for us to know that in a real materialistic society, people are concerned with how to balance their pious and impious activities. That's materialism, but it's sane materialism. People are concerned how to go to the heavenly planets. Again, materialism, but it's sane materialism. What you have today is not... Actually, it's a compliment to call people materialists today. Because by calling them materialists, you're implying they're expert at material things, which they are not. species that destroys its own habitat in the name of progress and advancement. Only human beings today are doing that. And they can't stop it. The governments can't stop it. The leaders can't agree on how to restrict their damage to their own habitat. The people can't control themselves. In spite of so much verbosity and research and studies, PhDs, no one can figure out that people need to learn how to control their minds and senses. All the talk about sustainable happiness, sustainable environment, sustainable this, sustainable that, it all depends on controlling the mind and senses. But no one has a program for that. The Vedic sages, especially in the Bhagavad school, are always grappling with this issue of how people can become purified. Just like in the Bhagavatam, in the fifth canto, Shukadeva Goswami had described the hellish planets. So, in the sixth canto, then Prichit Maharaj expresses his concern. You've described how people can destroy themselves by going to hellish situations. I'd like to know how they can become purified. That quest for purification is the hallmark of a real human civilization. And therefore, Prichit Maharaj's inquiry, of course, is so important. Actually, Srila Prabhupada pointed out that this first part of the sixth canto is so essential, not so much because of the near-death experience of Ajamya, but because it presents the triumph of the holy name in all circumstances. So he actually instructed that the first part of the sixth canto should always be in print as a mass distribution book. Of course, many are attracted to the story of Ajamya in terms of near death, but most important, beyond the details of the NDE, most important is the theology of the holy name and pure bhakti. So Prichit Maharaj is going through the various levels of a human society that's for real. In other words, a human society that's concerned with purification and removing the deadly effects of punya, sinful activity. So, Shukadeva Goswami is going to test Prichit Maharaj. How can people get free from sinful reactions? By atonement. And of course, Prichit Maharaj gives his famous answer, Priyashtatam Mato Pagdam, Manye Kundera Shocha. It's like taking an elephant bath. You perform sinful activity, and then you perform a pious activity to counteract it. You'll never get to the root of the problem. So this is good materialism, that you recognize that in living in this world, you're going to make some mistakes. So therefore you do some good deeds, and those good deeds are not what people think today. A good deed is whatever way you want to help people and feel good about it, that's a good deed, that's good karma. No. Pious activities, punya, are described explicitly in the Vedic texts. So a good materialist is concerned. I want the best possible outcome. Not simply in the present, but also in the future. Future means next life. So, how can I do all that? But Prichit Maharaj is pointing out, in response to Shukadeva Goswami's test, that this is a very ineffective method, performing a pious activity to counteract an impious activity. It's problematic. Karma is so complex. The laws of karma are so complex. You're sure
to make a mistake in that system. Somehow or other, you're going to slip up. Just like you read in the Krishna Leela about Maharaj Nirga, who performed such immense pious activities, but he made one slip. This is why, later in the sixth canto, when the Yama Dutas are dialoguing with the Vishnu Dutas, the Vishnu Dutas challenge, do you know actually who should be punished or who should not be punished? And the Yama Dutas replied that, basically, sooner or later, we're going to see everyone. Because you can't live in this world unless you're a bhakta. You can't live in this world and avoid tripping up, avoid doing some activity of bad karma. So therefore, the Yama Dutas said, more or less, we're going to come across everyone. Maybe not now, but maybe in your next life or 10 births from now, we'll be there for you. Because you're going to slip up. The nature of the material world is that you're entangled, you're blind, you're bewildered. This is why Krishna Maharaj rejected Shukadeva Goswami's first proposal to atone by performing a pious activity to counteract an impious activity. So then Shukadeva Goswami went to the next step. All right, you don't like that. How about Priyashtatam Vimarshani? You cleanse the sinful reactions by full knowledge, understanding what is pious, what is impious. And through immersion in full knowledge, you can prevent a lifestyle of bewilderment or a lifestyle of problems with material nature. Still, Krishna Maharaj said that doesn't work. He pointed out that it's just like a bamboo plant. You may burn away what's above the earth, what's above the surface of the earth, but what about the roots? What will pull out the roots of sinful desires? None of the methods that Shukadeva Goswami presented get to the root of the problem. That root is, I think I'm the enjoyer and controller. What is going to rid the conditioned soul of that horrible tendency? So that's when Shukadeva Goswami presents the ultimate and only real solution, pure devotional service, which just like when the sun rises and dispels all the fog, similarly, pure bhakti dispels completely the intricacies caused by contact with material nature. Someone who's actually concerned with the welfare of human civilization wants to understand what are the elements of a real human civilization. There's no question of solving the social, political, ecological ills of society today unless at least you begin to recognize the necessity for, as you heard in the previous verse, mental equilibrium and sense control. And you can hear from the greatest scholars of sustainability, the greatest scholars and proponents of what they now call sustainable happiness, as different from regular happiness. No one has a program for mind and sense control. All these PhDs, they construct such grand theories and proposals. We've got to cut back on this. We have to reduce our emissions. We have to reduce here and reduce there. But no one talks about mind and sense control. One famous environmentalist, he was advocating that once again people take up rural life. But he said,
isolated and they get bored very quickly. Therefore, they want to go back to the cities. But in these days, the whole problem of the rural exodus to the cities can be solved by making sure every rural home has the internet. And then people will feel completely connected, even though they're in rural areas and living simply. Of course, what is 80% of internet usage? Pornography. So no one has a proposal. No one's dealing with the necessity for mind and sense control. And mind and sense control is just it's kindergarten in Vedic civilization. In this verse today, Vidura is asking, please describe these various factors. The expansions of different sacrifices, because of real human civilization, is based on yajna. You recognize that you're indebted. You recognize that just by your existence in this world, you have to pay fees, user fees. And the yajna system is a prescribed way for paying the user fees, acknowledging that you're in debt, and also acknowledging your gratitude. So without a system of sacrifice in society, there's no way that people will recognize their dependency, recognize that they're in debt, and can properly express their gratitude. And then the paths of mystic power. Vishwanatha Chakravarti Thakur, in his commentary, describes that this is referring, this yogasya, paths of mystic power, is referring to Ashtanga Yoga, which, of course, in the age of Kali, will not bring you the culmination of its effects. Still, in a full-fledged human civilization, you have those who are dedicated to meditating on the super soul at the heart through Ashtanga Yoga. And then Sankhyasya, analytical study. This means looking at material nature in through a process prescribed by the Vedic knowledge. Not that you just look at material nature and speculate and call that Sankhya. There's a prescribed way, a delineated way, for how to analyze material existence and get to the root. That's the whole point of real Sankhya, to get to the root of material existence. So therefore, Prabhupada writes in the purport, Sankhya philosophy is the basic principle of acquiring knowledge, as will be explained by the sage Maitreya. The Sankhya philosophy enunciated by Kapila Deva, the son of Devahuti, is the real source of knowledge about the Supreme Truth. Knowledge not based on the Sankhya philosophy is mental speculation and can yield no tangible profit. If you actually follow Kapiladeva's Sankhya process, you'll get to the root. That's the purpose of knowledge. If you follow your own speculations in trying to analyze the material world, you'll never get to the root. You'll be bewildered lifetime after lifetime. Take away all these elements of a real human civilization, and of course, the culmination of a real human civilization is bhakti. That's why it is stated at the end here, Tantram va bhagavat smritam. The path of devotional service in relation with the personality of Godhead. A real human civilization is so merciful and so broad that it's able to take in all kinds of persons at different levels and gradually, if not immediately, bring them to bhakti. Take away all that, and you're just left with the crudest kind civilization, which is actually not materialistic. Because, as we said earlier, to call someone a materialist implies that they're expert at living material life. And we don't give them that credit. They're expert at destroying themselves. They're lousy materialists. A good materialist wants to enjoy now and next life. But who has that kind of thinking today? Then again, you can say accurately that they are materialists because so many of their leading intellectuals think, their leading scientists think, that there's nothing but matter and nothing beyond that. Actually, most people don't accept that. You'll find that in doing outreach, that most people think there's something spiritual about me, they have some spiritual intuition, but zero knowledge about it. Even, for example, I saw one social survey done in the UK. The UK is known as one of the least religious societies in the world. So, even though church attendance is so low, basically only immigrants go to church. You know, the British, they don't go to church. But still, only 13% of the people say that they believe that there's simply matter and nothing more. So the atheists in the UK, they complain that these people are not really irreligious. They have some spiritual notion of an afterlife, no matter how vague, or some kind of soul. But they just have no definitive knowledge of it. Yet they have these mythologies. So how can they really be irreligious? They have to become more advanced. They need to face the fact that there's just matter, just physical forces of the universe, nothing more. But actually, you'll find people have a hard time accepting that. They don't have any spiritual knowledge, but most of them can't just embrace the fact that they're just chemicals and that's all. You know, they always, I can't go that far. So this is the situation. There's a new term to describe these kind of persons who they don't espouse any religion, they're not following any spiritual path, they're not following any spiritual guidelines, they're not even thinking about anything spiritual. At the same time, they can't just embrace matterism, physical reductionism, that everything is just matter. So what's the word for them? It's called apatheism. Apathetic. Australia is like that, you know. Yeah, not that they're against religion, not that they're against spiritual thinking, but just who thinks about it, you know? There's sports, there's the pub, there's there's money, there's the beach. So this is called apatheism. They're not theists, but they're actually not atheists. They haven't, with their thought process, fully embraced an atheistic conclusion. This is theism, atheism, whatever. Where are the girls? That's the mindset. So you're forced, in that ignorance, you're forced to just glorify the moment. And that's what you have going on in society today. The magic of the moment. Just get some good moments in your life. And that's the full potential. Have a few moments of relationship bliss. Have some good sensuality. And then you die in peace. What more is there? Can't expect anything more than that. The happiness scholars, they, as I often point out, their general proposition is that 50% of your happiness is genetic. It's due to the genes you've inherited, and therefore you have a certain disposition. Supposedly parents can remember their child was from birth a cheery child or a very melancholy child. So, according to happiness scientists, 50% of your happiness is due to genes, genetic code. 10% is due to situations that are difficult to change.
your work, where you live, your marriage. It can be changed, but you can't do it overnight. It's a long time. So that's 10%. So that totals 60%, they say. And 40% is left to you and your own intention. And with that 40%, you can intend to be happy. You make up your mind to be happy no matter what. You've got that 40% window. But I tell people, Bhakti is offering 100%. Bhakti is not dependent on your genes. It's not dependent on your situations. So you've got 100% opportunity to hear Krishna's instructions and follow them and rise above material nature. Because as long as you are a puppet in the hands of material nature, you're never going to be happy, no matter how much intention you have, your 40% so-called intention. I will be happy no matter what. You're being dashed here and there by material nature. But people can't even see that. That's how low their civilization is. They can't even see their puppets in the hands of material nature. I glanced over one account of a person who the happiness scientists are putting forth as a model happy person. This person had made up his mind, no matter what, to be happy, and he would inspire others to be happy. And when people at his work were asked, do you know any truly happy persons here? The people at his workplace always point to him. He's always happy. So the happiness scientists wanted to make a point that this person was so expert at being happy that even in so-called tragedies, he still kept his intention to be happy. And this is the kind of inspiration that the people need. So, this topmost happy person, he went to the doctor, and the doctor told him that some disease that he had, which was in remission, had reappeared, and that he had only 7 months to live. So, the happiness scientists, some of them the Nobel Prize winners, they were describing how this expert in happiness responded, this person who's supposedly expert in living a happy life, how did he respond? First, he was just slammed, like, 7 months to live. But then, his happiness instincts took over him. And he said, okay, I'm going to take control of the situation. Doctor, tell me, for how long will I have enough energy to travel and meet all my relatives and friends? I'm taking charge of the situation. I'm going to be happy. Doctor, tell me, how will I manage the pain? Tell me all I need to do to manage the pain so that I can live a full life to the last minute. Explain everything to me, doctor. Just like Vidura is asking Maitreya to explain everything to him. So, doctor, explain to me, what will my passing be like? Maybe should I consider what they call an assisted death? Means someone helps you to just finish you off. Gives you some pills or something like that. Should I have an assisted death, or should I have a death this way or that way? I'm taking complete charge. So, what did he do? He got the jnana from the doctor, and he traveled the world going to all the spots he wanted to see. He visited all his friends and relatives, and then he died a good death. So this is what the happiness knowledge represents. This is a real life. So what do you think? A real life means to submit to material nature. We don't accept that. Just let nature's laws act upon me. I have no understanding of those laws of nature or how to counteract them, how to rise above them. I'm a happy person. I just live for the moment and don't care when is my saw all my relatives and friends. I traveled everywhere I wanted to see in the world before I died. I had pain management up to the last moment. I could choose if I go to certain states or certain countries of the world. I can choose an assisted death. I've done it. That's it. We don't accept this kind of civilization. A real human civilization begins with at least the elements of a plan, a process for counteracting material nature. Without that kind of understanding, your life is a failure. I remember once Srila Prabhupada describing very graphically this lifestyle of let nature's laws act upon me. He called it, this is a dog's life. The dog is also doing that. I'm going with the flow of nature. Let nature act upon me. The dog, of course, does that instinctively. Every human being lives like that. Oh, just go with the flow. It's all natural. Birth, death, old age, disease. Just accept it. Be happy amidst all that. We say this is not human life. So you have to see in yourself how much those contaminations are there. Western so-called civilization is based upon the dynamic of just, it's all about the moment. Even the Christian morality, one life is all you get. If you slip up, you burn in fire. If you do good, you go to heaven. It's one chance is all you get. So you got to make sure you're doing good things right now. And even though you're sinning, you just believe in the Savior. But you got to make sure you do all that. Even that's out the window now. Everything is all about the magic moment. How many magic moments have you had in your life? Look at your relationships. Are they still magical? Maybe you need to make a change. Is the job you're doing really inspiring you? Is it fulfilling you? Maybe you need to make a change. It's not too late. That's the best that society can give you. The magic of the moment. Good sense gratification. Help others to gratify their senses. That's doing a good deed. Good karma means helping others to gratify their senses. That's it. And then you can die in peace. There may be an afterlife, there may not be. But it's not important for you to figure it out. Just try to be a good person your own way, and surely the universe will take care of you. So this is so-called Western civilization. Now even in India, you know, they're catching up. Yes, this is such an attractive lifestyle. Why should you feel so fettered and so bound by prescriptions of human behavior? So this is why we need to understand the complete picture of a real human civilization. Because so deep in the Western world is this drive to just feel good for the moment. And sometimes our devotees, we have to wrestle with that. My senses are not being gratified at this moment. Is that good? There must be a problem. I'm believing in Krishna, but what about my senses? We have this corrupted idea that happiness will come by just letting your senses go wild. Where do we get this idea from? It's insane, but it's so deeply embedded in us because we're living in a consumer society with media distortions. And so these false assumptions go deep in us. So how to scrub all these deep assumptions, these mistakes. This is Pritchett Maharaj's concern. He was concerned not only in a real human civilization, but in any attempt at human civilization, how are you going to get to those core root assumptions, those mistakes of thinking you're the enjoyer and controller?
mistaken assumptions of the conditioned soul. Richard Maharaj accepted that. All right. Any questions? Any comments for Bhagavan Maharaj?
It would appear that this idea about getting your happiness in the material world and the Western world at the moment is kind of maybe at best, it's a approach to sattva, that you develop a little compassion and a little detachment and, you know, some sort of a little bit of sense control of this and that. And then you kind of exist kind of comfortably in the material world. And you have some idea that there is something beyond the body. That may be fixed. So it's like a getting on the verge of sattva, perhaps, is the best thing to do in terms of getting happiness. But of course, it's all temporary. So, and it's got nothing to actually do with the relationship between Atma and Krishna. So it can never be eternal. So at best, it's the compromise of the material world where you can accept the material world and accept its temporary nature and get a little bit of something out of there.
Can it be sattva if this life is full of rajagun activities, the basis?
Well, as you said, probably the better part of these people they'll do some more humanitarian type, sattvic, compassionate activities, and then they won't go for the upright things like drugs and things like this. So they'll try to control that to some degree. Of course, some people will get into that, but that's also everybody knows it's harmful. So they'll go for those things with maintaining the body, even
organic marijuana. Legal everywhere. In the Netherlands, I don't know. It's like water. Even in the Christian USA, marijuana is, so many states are legalizing. Washington, D.C. just legalized possession of marijuana. My mother she was 87, she was railing about that. Just see how sinful the world's becoming. Washington, D.C. has legalized marijuana. This degradation shows that Jesus is coming soon. The second coming is really So the standards of what's a good life, they change all the time. Just like in Western society, divorce used to be a bad thing. I mean, in the 50s, someone got divorced. It was unusual and it was looked down upon. Now in the Western world, divorce, it's a big deal. If you're not happy with someone, why should you stay with that person? And it's best for the children. If the parents are not happy with each other, it's better for the children that the parents divorce, because you don't want the children growing up with parents who are not happy with each other all the time. And anyway, the children will do the same thing when they get older. So why should the parents try to control themselves for the sake of the children when soon the children become teenagers? They're going to be chopping and changing relationships based on their momentary happiness. So the standard for what is good is always changing. So I told that to my mother. I said, 40 years ago when your children were at the university, you were so concerned whether they were smoking marijuana or not. You considered it from the devil and from the social point of view, you considered it to be reprehensible and very abominable. I said, what are you going to say now? It's legal everywhere. So the standards of what is good and what is nice are always changing. And no one has any fixed idea of what are the progressive elements of a real civilization. But sometimes I would wonder, why did the Bhagavatam go into all these things about different yajñas and mystic powers and sankhya this and so on and so forth. But you, after a while, you realize you're getting an overview of what is a real human civilization. And you start more and more to understand that you don't find
progressive elements in human society today. So besides understanding that bhakti is the ultimate, you also get the whole picture. I always tell the story of when Sankirtan devotee told me. She approached someone on the street in Auckland with a book, and immediately the person said, "No, I don't need it. I'm good. I know I'm good." And then he explained why. I know I'm good because, number one, I don't molest children. Number two, I don't park in car parks meant for the handicapped. I'm good. We don't. distribute books in Manhattan, and every fifth person you meet would say, "My guru's God. Why are you holding this book out to me? Don't you know? There's such and such Baba, he's God. Or such and such Rishi, he's God. Or Yogi so and so, he's God." Every fifth person. So, I remember Prabhupada at that time, he came to New York and he said, "Go on with this Harinam Sankirtan, this book distribution. One day, all these bogus gods and yogis, they'll be diminished." It was hard for us to accept that. It's like, one day there won't be any sunshine. It's like, but they were so omnipresent. But then we indeed saw, within a year or two, the supply coming in on Air India, it all diminished. There are just a few. Right now, there are just very few who will go around campaigning, "I am God, you are God." But in 73, there was one who would fill a whole sports stadium with 60,000 people. The boy God. Similarly, Prabhupada told us if his books are distributed behind the Iron Curtain, communism is finished. Seemed impossible. When the Iron Curtain fell, even the CIA said they were caught off guard. They never expected it was going to unravel like that. So we don't know the full effects of distributing bhakti. There are even effects you can see in the material sphere. What to speak of the spiritual sphere. So we do our little bit as humble servants of the Parampara. Associating with devotees who are more advanced than you, you'll become more advanced. Even when you have to make a gallant effort in bhakti, later you'll recognize that it's actually happiness. You see what's going on. Your conceptions of happiness are changing. So you have to give that a chance to happen. You're moving from me-centered, so-called happiness to Krishna-centered happiness. So in the beginning, it can look like pain. But that's just a misperception. What's happening is we're making that shift from serving our own mind and senses and being concerned with me, to being concerned with Krishna's pleasure, Krishna's service. So in the transition towards that, it can seem like we're not happy, even though we're suffering. We're in the convalescent stage. We're getting over the disease. We're not really healthy yet, but we're making progress away from the disease. So understand the dynamics of what's going on. Your whole conception of happiness is changing. Your whole experience of happiness is changing. Instead of everything for me and my senses, how do I feel? It's how can Krishna best be served? Remember earlier in this chapter, Vidura said to Maitreya, what is it? Maitreya said it to Vidura in their conversation. There are only two kinds of people who can be happy in this world. One is the self-realized soul, and the other is the complete fool. Everyone in between suffers a bit of anxiety. course, the complete fool thinks he's happy through such low-grade activities.